There we go. Did anyone not hear me? First item of order is the minutes. Anyone want to volunteer a motion for the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vigo. So moved. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion prevails. First order of business is House File 1366. Chair Heintzman, you're already at the testifier table. Understand that you also have an A1 amendment you'd like to move. I'll move that for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is it in the order you'd like at this point?
I'm sorry, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Repeat that.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment, members? All in favor of the A1?
Aye.
Aye. Nate? All opposed? All right. Motion carries. Representative Heisman. Chair Heisman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, today before you, House File 1366, as amended, is a bill that would replace existing turbine generators in the Brainerd Hydro Dam and put in some new equipment. And I have a testifier here today, Mr. Chair, who can quickly walk the committee through that.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Evans, and I am the Director of Brainerd Public Utilities in Brainerd, Minnesota. Thank you for hearing House File number 1366. This important bill provides funding for upgrading structure and components at our locally owned hydroelectric facility. We have a handout in the member packets that will give you some details and pictures of our facilities. The city took ownership of this historical site 11 years ago. The site runs mostly with original and vintage equipment. With that equipment, we achieve less than 5% of our city's annual demand. By implementing and leveraging the new technology, it will help our community utilize local renewable and clean energy for a portion of our electrical needs as we continue our journey on the pathway to meeting our 2040 energy standards. We can more than double the present output of this in-state homegrown renewable resource by upgrading the technology and equipment to harness the power of the water provided by the Mississippi very efficiently, even at low flows. I would also like to add that we recognize the budget challenges that the state faces and would be grateful for any consideration that might be able to provide. Our plan is to invest $14 million over the next 4 years to get this facility to the new capacity level. You all are invited to visit the site. Thank
Recording
you again.
In progress.
It just happens from time to time. Feel free to continue.
Oh, thank you. thank you again, and my staff and I can stand for any questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heinzman, or to your testifier, I'm a little confused because this, and I know I'm newer here, but this seems like a bonding project and not an energy project, and I'm just wondering why this wasn't going to capital investments.
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to answer the question, there's been a ongoing conversation as to what the best path is for this. At the moment, this is kind of where we've landed. It may show up in another bill in another way.
Representative Hollins, any additional questions?
Thank you. Yes. Follow-up question. How many customers does Brainerd Public Utilities serve?
Thank you for the question. The city size is right at 15,000.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. And so the public utility serves the entire city of Brainerd. Does it serve any outside of the city?
Chair Heinzman.
Brainerd Public, thank you again for the question. Brainerd Public Utility serves the city limits of Brainerd as well as some territory within the city of Baxter. And we have some outlying areas in some of the township and unincorporated area.
Representative Hollins.
Okay, thank you. And so if you were to ask the the people, the ratepayers for the BPU to pay for these upgrades, what would the impact be on them?
Thank you. Obviously, the Brainerd currently is in four census tracts as far as poverty, the economic development side of it. So we are very conscious of trying to keep our rates low. As far as the benefit, the hydro is just part of our renewable portfolio that we are currently have. When I say that, we have purchase power agreements with AEP right now for two solar projects that are in the city. And between the solar projects and the hydro projects, that the renewables support roughly 3,000 households. And again, this project is to try to keep low and available electric costs and to help meet our goals for the 2030, 2035, 2040 targets for clean energy.
Representative Allens.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. You know, I was going to say that it feels like this is socializing the cost of this across the state for the benefit of a few people, but I also appreciate the fact that a lot of the folks there are lower income and you're trying to keep the rates low for them, so I'm not going to accuse you of socialism. One further question?
Yes, ma'am.
How's this moving in the Senate?
Chair Hensman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I led with, this is a conversation starter, and we're going to continue to see what the right path is if this does rise to a level that it earns support from both chambers and here in the House. It could, like I had also mentioned earlier, show up in a couple different ways. There is the challenge of the mandate that was mentioned a few moments ago and attempting to address that with hydro and solar and other tools. It's going to be very challenging, Representative Hall. So we're working towards that in this proposal. Maybe it's rejected and it isn't moving forward, and it would be a further challenge to achieving those required mandates that we're looking at in 2035. But maybe this is something that should earn your consideration and support today. We'll see how things go.
Nothing further?
No further questions.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. This is to either of you, whoever knows. So I'm particularly interested in this. I'm surprised that we don't have more water dam power that's produced. So why are only two turbines operating?
Turns.
Out of the five.
Thank you for the question. Again, as I stated in my earlier comments, that this plant is historical. It's well over 120 years old. It was originally a hydro facility for the paper mill that was in the town at the time. So we have two generators that actually date back to 1912. So they've been in service for 112 years, basically. At this time, we have some of the older units. One is down for maintenance. The other one, not to get too technical, but requires a governor to actually control the flows just because of how the generation works. And so that's the reason that we're down those number of units. But again, going back to their age and size, that when they are up and going, that, you know, we get 5 to 7% of our total needs now. Whereas the new technology with the new generators, they can operate more efficiently, as well as operate in periods of low flow on the Mississippi. As you're probably aware, that we are probably like 3 or 4 years into a drought. So the normal flows that come through that part of the Mississippi haven't necessarily been there, and so the output is proportional to flow. So the new technology would give us opportunity to generate more energy even at times of low flow.
Representative Carroll.
Okay. I guess I didn't hear a response, but you can move on.
Chair Aikum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question probably for the testifier, you said that you acquired the dam 11 years ago. Who had it prior to that?
Chair Heinzen.
Who had the dam prior?
Prior to that, it was an asset of the paper mill that was in town.
Anything further?
Yes, follow up, please. Okay, so then when the utility acquired it, was there and has there been like an account for operation and maintenance on the facility, recognizing that maybe some improvements would need to be made?
Chair Hensman.
Yes, thank you for the question. Part of this ask today is for some structural updates to the facility, but obviously we follow proper accounting standards, so we do keep track of the depreciation and the operational cost of the facility.
Chair Aitken.
Thank you. So I think, Chair Heintzman, you mentioned that this is maybe the start of a conversation. Has there been any investigation as to opportunities with the federal government for investments with or on the dam?
Chair Heintzman.
I have not instigated those conversations, but there may be others that have without me being aware of it.
Chair Aitken.
Thank you. Listen to the presentation, which I do think that this is a, you know, worthwhile endeavor to increase the generation. Not sure I think this is the appropriate place for that funding to come from, and want to also point out that if I understand correctly, the rates of your utility are significantly lower than the rates Minnesotans pay on average, and so I think I would like to maybe understand with this ask how much of the investment is intended to come from ratepayers of the Brainerd utility.
Mr. Chair
Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ackam. So one of the challenges is that energy from sources, hydro, solar, wind, tend to be more expensive. And that is a challenge that we're addressing as we're trying to move this forward. And maybe this isn't the right choice, but I hope that, just like I had said, and I think that was just acknowledged, that this is a start of a conversation.
Chair Aitken.
Thank you. And just a comment to that, that the cheapest forms of generation right now are actually wind and solar. And so your comment about it being the most expensive is just not accurate. But
Mr.
thank
Chair.
You, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that.
Representative, any final comments on that?
No, I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the opportunity to talk about your bill. I am curious more about the workings of it. You had mentioned that, at first I also want to commend you for keeping a piece of equipment that's 112 years old in operation. That's really commendable. But I want to know, what would be the capacity, kind of the in like megawatts, of a full operational plant?
Thank you for the question. I could defer that to my operations manager, Trent Hawkinson. He's the technical guy, so he can answer all the specific questions such as what you asked. So,
Mr. Hawkins, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trent Hawkinson, Brainerd Public Utilities Operations Manager.
Thank you.
Could you please restate the question, please?
Yes, thank you. I am curious about what would be the capacity if it was fully brought online with the five generators.
So right now, the current capacity with our connected load would be about 3.2 megawatts is what we can generate today with the all five units running online.
Okay.
Representative
thank you.
Jones.
That's it. Thank you.
Anything further? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jones kind of took the question I was going to ask. You know, for being over 100 years old, keeping two of those antique generators running to me is a compliment to your maintenance staff. I mean, these things are big, heavy duty, and big hunks of iron. So congratulations on keeping them going. And, you know, this kind of fascinates me that getting power like that from the dam and the river. So whether this is the right place or not, I support the project. So thanks, Representative Heintzelman.
Representative Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Heinzman, I was just curious, you know, as far as what the life of the hydro plant would be. I mean, the first group seemed to last pretty long. Our recycling costs are pretty low up to this point. But how long do you expect these new generators to last?
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for the question. I doubt 120 years. As was mentioned earlier, you know, referencing the age of the equipment, it is astonishing to see Babbitt bearings still in use and some of the technology there and the size of the equipment. But I would defer to my testifier on what the longevity might be for modern equipment.
Hawkins.
Thank you for the question. Typically right now we're looking at about 25 years for a total rebuild. So these units have been rebuilt over the years, rewound, some different things like that. So the existing generation today, we think we can keep going for another 100 years, to be honest. The challenges we find there are finding parts and pieces to keep something that now could be 200 years old operating. The new generation now at 25 years of a total rebuild will continue to prolong the longevity for this for many years to come.
Representative Murphy, further question.
Thank you. Just a follow-up, you know, if you're looking at the amount of money you're asking for and the amount of people you're servicing, even if you got 50 years out of it, we'd still only be looking at about $90, you know, a resident per year to have this source. And we don't have zero recycling of all of the parts to deal with. And this is a natural resource, so I think it looks like a good option. Thanks.
Any further discussion from members? Any other testifiers? Chair Hyman's final comments.
Thank you, members, for the opportunity to present the bill.
All right. Before we do that, I just want to comment, having worked on a bunch of pumps for pump stations, fantastic opportunity. This is the kind of power that we're going to be able to run regardless if the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. So it's a great baseload opportunity for the city of Brainerd. So I'd love to see the project go forward. Thank you. And for at this time, we'll be laying the bill over with that. Chair Zawinski, Chair Akin, thanks for the opportunity to hold the gavel momentarily. I'll be passing the gavel to Representative Wiener.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Sexton, Chair Swazinski, Chair Akam, for the opportunity to chair the Energy Committee today. Our second bill today is 2803 from Representative Hudson. And you are seated already. Thank you very much. I move that 2803 be moved to be laid over. And I also understand, Representative, that you have a DE amendment that you'd like to get in, add to this bill. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the DE.
Okay. I would like to move the DE amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion prevails. Representative Hudson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 2803 is a bill that would ensure that our transition as a state towards clean energy does not come at the expense of child exploitation. What it does is it requires that large energy infrastructure projects and carbon-free technologies, and indeed all large energy infrastructure projects, whether they're considered to be clean energy or not, certify that they were not did not have child labor involved in their supply chain before they can secure a permit from the commission in order to move forward. That's the basics of it. We can get into more details as we go through testimony and discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hudson. We don't have any other testifiers at this time. Is there anyone from the public who would wish to testify? Seeing none, we'll open it up to member discussion. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee, Representative Hudson. So appreciate your bringing some focus on child labor. It certainly is a very important issue. And I think, you know, should be a concern to all of us at all levels. In this area, it's generally a pretty heavy focus for the federal government. Why are you suggesting that as a state government we take it on when I can't find any other states that are doing that? Not that we can't be first, right? But I can't find any other states that are doing this.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft, both for your welcome. It's actually after 3 years the first time I've been in this room. It's always nice to discover new areas. Yes. Yeah, yeah. But to your question, so why Minnesota? Why at the state level? I thought about that long and hard, actually. You know, Minnesota has a proud tradition of moral leadership in this country, in the United States. In fact, if you walk these Capitol grounds outside and even throughout the building, we make tribute to individuals who've been important figures in our state's history who did exactly that, who led on issues specifically of moral and social importance long before others followed their path that they found. I think we can honor that legacy by implementing something like this. I think we have for far too long patted ourselves on the back as being ethical and moral and righteous and benevolent because here in our country and in our state, we have a wide variety of regulations and laws that are intended to create a economy that is to the best extent possible, free of exploitation. Issues like wage theft and discrimination and our Human Rights Act and a variety of other issues. We've gone to great lengths as a legislature in order to keep our people from being exploited. At the same time, our economy benefits from those same exploitations taking place in other parts of the world. And we seem to be comfortable with that and continue to pat ourselves on the back. I think that is a type of moral hypocrisy that Minnesota's leadership in this area would signal to the rest of our several states and to the nation as a whole and to the world as a whole that we are going to remedy through an action like this.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudson. So I also noticed that within, you spoke about within Minnesota, that there's been, have you noticed that there's a rising amount of child labor law violations in our state over the past several years? And if that's of interest, I'd be interested in working on that with you. So have you noticed that? And is that something you're considering? So let's say, have you noticed that?
Representative Hudson.
I'll take your word on it. It is not something that has been brought to my attention specifically, but certainly we should be addressing that in addition to addressing it throughout our economy and supply chains.
Any follow-up,
yes.
Representative Kraft?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I would ask a question, a few other things. Why this specific area? Because there are many areas. I mean, you could look at chocolate, cocoa. There's a significant area of where there's child labor violations around the world. Aluminum, palm oil, makeup, cosmetics. Why focus on this specific area, and why aren't you looking at things more broadly than this?
Representative Hudson.
It's a fantastic question, and I have two answers. The first is I'm entirely open to casting the net wider and looking at ways how we could be more conscientious and how we engage with the global economy to ensure that we are not taking comfort in our own abundance and luxury at the expense of the exploitation of people around the world. That's the first answer. My second answer as to, in this instance, why am I proposing this specifically for large energy infrastructure projects? It's because I've happened to notice that in this sector, there seems to be a disproportionate amount of reliance upon other nations' lower standards of both environmental impact and the exploitation of human beings that we, in my opinion, have way too much comfort with. And I did not bring stats to back up that sentiment, unfortunately, but I would stand by and put my money on the bet that this industry is disproportionately responsible for that particular type of imbalance between how we get our things versus where they come from.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not so sure about that, but we don't need to debate which supply chain is worse. There's significant issues to address. So given that, what you've said, you've noticed this area, then is it also something that you have will join me in supporting and pushing back on the Trump administration's consideration of stopping investments in the Inflation Reduction Act, which many of those are meant to onshore the production of solar panels, batteries, things like that, that may be things you have noticed with this child labor? Because that's one of the, we're hearing that that is going to be disinvested, and that is a way to kind of root cause to drive more of that investment into our country. Will you join me in rejecting that?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft. I'm unfamiliar with the specific provisions that you're talking about that may be being pursued by the Trump administration. What I will say is that as a matter of principle, I do believe the best thing for us to do is to onshore the manufacture of the materials that we use for our supply chain. That's the way we used to do it. That's what fueled the middle class. What we've seen in the state of Minnesota as a result of actions taken by the previous administration is that our ability to be able to produce things here in Minnesota, particularly through the mining industry, has been greatly impacted to the negative. I mean, we just saw 600 people laid off up in the Iron Range at a mining facility, or 600, sorry, folks who are laid off. I mean, we're not doing ourselves any favors by relying upon foreign entities to provide us with materials for our supply chain, both in terms of our own populations, our own residents' economic best interest, and also the moral and ethical and social interests that are so often invoked in this body as justification for imposing all manner of mandates, with many of which we've seen over the past 2 years, on businesses to do things in certain ways. Again, I don't think we ought to take great comfort and pat ourselves on the back for performatively doing things that apply here while benefiting from violations of the underlying ethical and moral principles elsewhere in the world.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Hudson, I'll be sure to share with you those provisions where the administration is trying to roll back some of this stuff, and we can, we'd love to work with you on that. As I said, I share your concern on child labor. I just question where the best place to pursue this is. Have you discussed how we would, with any agency that would have to implement this, how they would do it and how much it would cost to do such a thing? And then, because I'd also like that for this, as well as if we're going to do this, then we should look broader than just this specific industry.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you once again, Representative Kraft. I have not engaged in those discussions, to borrow a term from Representative Heintzman that he used in his presentation just now. This is a conversation starter. I'm certainly happy to, the bill's being laid over, I'm certainly happy to start to engage in those conversations. But fundamentally, I think the idea of evoking cost when we're talking about trying to pursue a moral good, you know, it's something that is not without historical precedent. I'm sure there were conversations back in the 1860s about what the economic impacts were going to be of the Emancipation Proclamation. Thank God those concerns did not keep us from doing the right thing as a nation and ending that horrendous practice 160 years ago. And while we're on that topic, you know, that gets evoked, that historical national sin gets evoked quite a bit in this body and in the broader public discourse. And I gotta say, I'm not particularly impressed with performative indignance about a human atrocity that ended 160 years ago while we continue to benefit from and profit from and live in comfort as a result of that same human atrocity taking place today around the world. And so when we talk about cost, is there going to be a cost to doing the right thing? Yes, there is a cost to a burglar not burglarizing. They have to actually earn their money now, and it's going to be more expensive than stealing from other people. That's a cost, but it's the right thing to do. And so whatever the cost is, I think it's something we need to seriously consider.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I will say, Representative Hudson, you talked about cost and a moral good. I mean, I could make those kinds of discussions. You know, we're talking about our energy system here and the significant cost our continuing burning of fossil fuels is placing on my kids, our future generations, and generations beyond. And, you know, if I were to make that argument, cost doesn't matter, right? We should do that to, yeah, I think there would be some on the other side that would be, contest that a bit. Appreciate your statements there, but I will say, you know, I'd be interested in working more on this. I'm fine with this as a conversation starter, but if you're to come to this committee and to think that this is something that we could actually adopt without understanding how we would do it and the cost behind it, like what would it, and I would say compared to what levers the federal government has, is it better for us to do things here, or is it better for us to work with the federal government to push and make sure that they're where they have some maybe more leverage than we do? So to come here, we can, as a conversation starter, fine, but as a legitimate policy option, I think this is sorely lacking. So I appreciate it being laid over, and I'm happy to continue the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Next, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair Weiner, Representative Hudson. Very interesting idea. Just looking at it, I think I saw the same news articles as Representative Kraft had mentioned. I think we just saw USDA 2 days ago talking about how Minnesota is on the rise of child labor, and particularly certain areas as well. But you know, and then watching what's going on internationally with resource acquisition, whether that's cobalt or copper or any of those things. I think those are, you know, and I think the difference would be, you know, it was brought up as examples like cosmetics or palm oil or others. Why don't we look at those? And, you know, primarily I think, you know, probably the stark difference would be that we have a state mandate. You know, we're not mandating. Why I think your idea is has a little bit more legs on it than other industries is that we have a state mandate, we have a state rule, carbon free by 2040. We have, you know, we have programs that give taxpayer dollars to these industries so that they will build this stuff. Subsidies from the federal level, subsidies from the state level, all while supporting the quote unquote the cheapest energy available. And, you know, I think that's probably, you know, maybe if we're looking for a reason why we would even get engaged in this conversation of ideas, why it would maybe take precedence other areas is that we as a legislative body actually are making decisions, essentially moving the goalposts essentially on generation. And, you know, just Minnesota's own headlines just 2 days ago was talking about how we're on a rise. And, you know, I think it's actually pretty timely, quite frankly, that we're here in this bill. I want to thank the chair and Hudson for bringing the bill forward. And, yeah, so there you go.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Not hearing a question in that, I guess we'll go to Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill so we can have a conversation about it. Just hearing the conversation so far, I was actually just thinking about, you know, part of the issue is, you know, we use energy when we need to use energy. But a question for you, what is the cleanest and cheapest form of energy? I'm just curious.
Representative Hudson.
I do not have access in front of me to the latest statistics on that.
Okay.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. It's actually one of my favorite phrases. Is the cheapest and cleanest kilowatt hour is the one that we never use. So I think this bill honestly also helps to make the case around energy efficiency. When we can use energy more efficiently, when we can conserve energy, when we invest in programs that help us to do that, that helps to lessen any of the concerns or many of the concerns that are mentioned here. And not only energy in our homes, but also in our vehicles as well. So if we think about how we're designing our cities, making sure that the places where we want to go are closer so we can have opportunities to get there via multiple different modes, that it doesn't take as much energy to get to those different places. So I honestly really appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about energy efficiency, because it is just, it's one of those things that is a win-win-win. It's a win for the environment. It's a win for child labor. It's a win for our pocketbooks and for our communities. So thank you.
Thank you for your statement, Representative Jones. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I am glad that this is a bill that is looking to prevent child labor, because we are seeing bills in other states that are looking to ease the ability for there to actually be child labor and to make it legal. So thank you for bringing something opposite of that. We can get into a whole political philosophy about that, but that's not why we're here today. But you did mention the atrocity of slavery in this country. And you would agree that there was a great cost to the folks that were enslaved. Would you agree to that?
Absolutely.
Would you also agree that there's a debt owed to those folks that were enslaved?
Representative Hudson.
To my knowledge, none of those folks who were enslaved are alive today.
Representative Frazier.
Are you familiar with the way a state law works?
Representative Hudson.
It's a crash course that I've been on for going on 3 years.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you. If there is a debt owed to an estate, the descendants of that estate are entitled to collect on that debt. So would you agree that there's a debt owed to those folks that were enslaved?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I'll note that I think we're exceeding the scope of the bill, but I'm happy to answer the question at any regard, because it is an important question. I think my concern is twofold. One, to Representative Kraft's point, if we're going to play this game, we're never going to stop playing it, because there are a lot of people groups who have abused and enslaved and murdered and raped and killed other people groups throughout history. If we're going to go back decades upon decades, centuries upon centuries, and try to right all those wrongs through modern redistribution of wealth, I think that's a game that we're never going to stop. That's a merry-go-round that we're never going to get off of, number one. Number two, I'm just not sure how we would apply it. Like, for instance, my heritage. I'm virtually everything under the sun, as far as I know. I'm what you might call a mutt. My mom's white, my dad's black. Does that mean that I'm just, like, I'd even out? Right? I'm not owed anything from anyone because I have equal heritage, presumably, that was on both sides of that moral imbalance. How do we administer that justly? That's the difficulty. And thirdly, coming to mind, I think the focus on past historical debts does two things that are counterproductive. One, it promotes modern day division that does not naturally exist. I've talked before on the House floor about, and this is no longer the situation because one of the families moved, but my youngest son used to play outside with two neighbor kids, one of whom was across the street and was East African immigrant, first generation American, and another one a couple doors down that was white kid, blonde hair, blue eyes. And my kid is quarter black. And so here they are, the full spectrum of the racial rainbow, having fun, enjoying each other's company, doing the things that kids do, getting into fights, apologizing to each other, going out and playing again the next day. Not a care in the world about what each other looks like, not evaluating each other on that basis. And then we're going to send them to school and teach them that, no, actually,
he owes you a debt because of something that happened to your great-great-grandfather that your great-great-grandfather may have not actually been had any connection to whatsoever. I think that's a divisive concept. I think it's counterproductive in that way. And I also think it's counterproductive because it furthers the idea in the heads of the people who it's meant to uplift that they can't, that they're incapable, that they're weighed down, and that they can't succeed, that they're not part of our broader society, that they don't have the ability to prosper and to live virtuous lives and to be productive, and that's simply not true.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. And I think we're getting away from the scope of this bill, if we could narrow this down a little bit. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for that. It didn't answer what the question that I had, though. My question was around this idea, and I think this, the state law is a great analogy to what we're talking about here. Now, I have a bill that you can get on if you want that would address the idea of how we address this thing. We would create a study. We would look at everything. We can look at data. We can determine how we can decide who would be folks that would benefit from the debt that is owed. And it doesn't have to be straight cash. There are many things. There were many things that were created as barriers because folks were enslaved. And then when the Emancipation Act happened, it was just like, go. Now you're free. Catch up after 400 years. Impossible to do that. What I will say is that anytime I've collected a debt, I've never felt less than. I've never felt like I couldn't achieve something because I've collected that debt. I've only felt that the debt has been paid, and now things have been made right. And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Frazier. There are no question there. We'll go to the next testifier, Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for the bill today. I appreciate the thought process you went into this, and thank you for bringing up the range and its importance in all this. So it was refreshing to hear that, so just thank you for your knowledge and support on that. But really, I think this gets at, and members who have been on me with energy before, we've had this conversation before. I think it is our moral impediment that we do take this under consideration, right? I mean, we've passed quite a few laws over the last couple of years that we maybe didn't know how we were going to implement them right away. And we still chugged ahead, and they were passed. And now we're dealing with that right now. And I think the fact that you have a member that's brought a bill to us today that says, no, let's lay it over and let's work on it, we should be very encouraged and happy that someone's taking leadership to say, yes, we need to take steps. But rolling up our sleeves and doing the right thing is the way to go, right? Anything worth doing is not easy. And this would be hard, but the benefits would be strong. Because I'll go back to an argument I made 2 years ago when we talk about 2040, that if we really want to say we've achieved 2040, we want to achieve a 2040 knowing that we didn't, you know, destroy the environment on the other side of the world and enslave children. And I think that should be something that's very important, close to home, and should cross all political boundaries that we should stand united on. So I appreciate how straightforward the bill is because it gets at one of the core pillars of one of the largest problems. And as someone that's done some research into this and looked into this, when you go to places like Indonesia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and you see the conditions, one, the first thing that you'll catch is the 8-year-old child that is in the bottom of the hole that is covered in dirt with no protective gear, no shoes, and is trying to get these minerals out of the ground to build what the bill is getting at. But then if you pan out of that image, that image enough is alone to hurt, traumatize, and really give you a fire in your belly to want to make a difference on that. But when you pan out and then you see where they're living and what their environment looks like because of the zero regulations that are around that, then it gets really haunting. And by taking a step like this and by saying that we aren't going to allow companies and countries to be able to destroy the next generation of human beings and the environment for all future generations, we can start to slow that ebb and we can really make a difference. And this committee knows, and I'll say it again, everything that would be covered in this bill today can be taken out of the ground 200 miles north of this capital and can be done in a way that protects the environment, protects labor laws, and Minnesota can be the leader. But it's not just Minnesota. We're finding these things now all over our country. And maybe, and maybe Representative Kraft, we can have a discussion on this too, but talking about some of the Trump administration pulling back on some of these onshoring effects, maybe they're pulling back because they don't want to invest in facilities that are still taking these raw materials that are destroying the earth and destroying families. And I haven't looked enough into that proposal yet to see if that's the case, but that's maybe where my mind goes right away. Because when we talk about the war in Ukraine, I know that the United States of America, even this state included, divested from Russia. The United States put sanctions, divested, did everything they could in Russia, except for one thing. We increased demands of nickel. So our demand for clean energy is funding a war effort to oppress and destroy another country. That is a very staggering and wrong move by our country when we have those resources here. So, Representative Hudson, I really appreciate this bill because this conversation needs to be had more and it needs to be had louder. Because if we continue down this path of anything that's inside the map of Minnesota, we're going to control. But anything else, we'll just put blinders on because it doesn't matter then, right? And I think we deal with that on a larger scale outside of what the bill is even getting at. We deal with that inside our legislative districts. We deal with that inside our communities, inside of our friend circles. And it's a larger political problem that we cannot legislate. And I'm well aware of that. But if we want to start functioning better as a society and we want to start functioning better as a state and as a nation, it's time to start breaking down the barriers that putting on blinders does nothing but revert us back to tribalism. And if we want to be a civilization, we want to be people that live and prosper in harmony and build a better world for the next generation, it's time to start breaking down those barriers, and this bill today does that. Thank you, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Representative Igo. Seeing no other questions, comments from the committee, your final statements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the conversation. I think I'll say this, just reflecting upon the things that have been said here today. So, Representative Kraft, you brought up that you could use the same moral argument that I'm bringing to bear for this bill in opposition to child labor abroad and that's used in the supply chain for our large energy infrastructure projects, that you could use the same underlying moral argument that cost doesn't matter when it comes to combating climate change. And what I don't want to debate here today, but what I do want to acknowledge is that there is broad disagreement, not about the nature of climate change, but the severity and the urgency required to combat it. That is something that there's an ongoing conversation about as to what is the good that is actually being achieved and at what cost in that particular area. And again, not looking to debate it, but simply acknowledge it. Nobody is debating whether or not children should be in pits somewhere on the globe without protective equipment, without basic clothing, digging rocks out of the ground. There's no debate on that. And so the moral premise stands on a solid foundation of we should take action to combat that with our economic power here in the United States and in the state of Minnesota. This bill does that, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. And with that, House File 2803, as amended, is laid over. Once again, thank you, Representative Swazinski, Chair Swazinski, Chair Acom. Thanks for the opportunity to chair this committee, and I have to say, Chair Wiener has a nice ring to it, so with that, I'll pass it over to Representative Mecklen.
There he is. I didn't see Mr. Burke. Okay. Thank you, Representative Wiener, and thank you to Chair Acom and Chair Swedinski for this opportunity. I welcome Representative Burkle. Today you have House File 1859. Are we laying this over? Okay. I will move House File 1859 to be laid over for further discussion. And I believe you have a DE amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that amendment.
Or I will move your DE amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, DE amendment is just simply to take the original 1859 and substitute language that's probably a little more palatable to some in the room. The 1 mile setback was a conversation starter, as we've talked about today, and we're looking at 500 feet. You can see the amendment in your packet. I'd like to have the A1 amendment moved, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we all know that life takes energy, and I think we'd all agree that it is our responsibility in society to deliver safe and reliable power where it's needed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think we all agree as well that there's a place for all types of energy with an understanding that wind power has a place and has a role. House File 1859 is amended. Is an attempt to address concerns of several of my constituents back home, among others in the state. You'll hear from my testifiers today about their recognition that clean renewable energy is a positive, such as wind, it has its place. But you'll also hear the concerns, and I wanted to give voice to those concerns today. Concerns about noise pollution, concerns about land values, and just concerns that I think are valid and need to be pushed forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to yield my time to my testifiers and let them kind of share their concerns with the committee.
Thank you. Mr. DeZingle, if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. I would like to thank the chairman, committee members, and my representative for allowing me to speak on HF 1859. My name is Paul DeZingle. I am a farmer from Kennedy, Minnesota. After living in the small city of Fargo for nearly 10 years, I am now blessed with the ability to live and work in the quiet, peaceful farmland of the Red River Valley. This peace and quiet is now threatened by the planned wind farm that will surround my home and complicate my ability to produce crops in the surrounding fields. I understand the importance of energy diversification, especially for the need of renewable clean energy, but have not seen a study that considers living inside a wind turbine grid as opposed to the effects of living just near one. The studies I have seen have reported no downsides outside of a 2 kilometer distance. 2 kilometers is over 1 mile and quite a bit further than the 500 foot boundary that the amendment proposed. The odd thing about wind energy production is that it is the only energy production that will place homes in the middle of their generating system, something that will surround me and my families with the sounds and vibrations that not normally forced upon the general public. Most wind energy companies opposed to this will cite wind energy being an economic opportunity for communities and landowners, but not necessarily for those who must live and work in such close proximity. When these towers are not actively generating energy, they do not benefit the community or landowners. In fact, these generating structures, as I am aware, are not taxed as normal property, as they are only taxed when they are actively generating power and revenue. As a farmer, it would sure be nice if my grain bins were only taxed when they created revenue, as they are generally empty for 75% of a year. And what is to happen to these structures once they reach the end of their 35-year life? Will these companies see to it that they are decommissioned properly, or will they sell them to another company with the promise to use them? What prevents the buyer from simply declaring bankruptcy, leaving these turbines to sit as an unproductive eyesore that the landlord and the community must live with? Being 34 years old, it pains me to think that I will be stuck living in close quarters with these for the rest of my working life as I try to make my living around them. In closing, I feel there is need to be more studies that specifically research the effects of being surrounded by wind turbines at close proximity before we allow more of these structures to disrupt the peace and quiet of our households. An ideal boundary of 1 mile between wind turbines and residential land would comply with current studies. If this seems like such an insurmountable distance for energy companies, a compromise could be reached with an amendment that would give each household the ability to sign a waiver to accept the construction of turbines at the current setback to better serve the communities affected. This will allow future development to continue with increased support while allowing those like me to continue living peacefully and healthy, productive lives at home. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next testifier we have is Nathan Dull. You can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Meckland, co-chairs Swazinski and Akam, and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Dull. I serve as the senior field manager with the Minnesota Land and Liberty Coalition. We're a statewide group of farmers, landowners, ratepayers, business and community leaders, and advocates of an all-the-above energy strategy for Minnesota. We're united by support for protecting private property rights, investing across Minnesota, building a resilient, reliable energy grid, and ensuring the United States' national security. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you to Representative Burkle for bringing House File 1859 for discussion. We appreciate the author's amendment to the bill, as we believe the original language would have threatened private property rights and deterred significant private investment in greater Minnesota communities. We also appreciate the provision by allowing for reduced setback if mutually agreed upon by both project and residence owners. We are concerned, however, that uniformly applying a 500-foot setback to wind and solar projects overlooks the significant operational and structural differences between the technology and places unnecessary restrictions on solar development. Minnesota Land and Liberty is active in 55 counties across Minnesota, and in our experience, even the counties with the most restrictive policies toward solar have a setback between about 100 and 200 feet from the center line of a county or principal arterial roadway. That compared to the bill's 500-foot setback from the edge of the road. While residential setbacks vary more, they typically range from 2 to 500 feet depending on zoning district, project size, and other considerations. Fundamentally, we believe that counties are best positioned to determine these setbacks as each project and each parcel of land is unique. Codifying a setback like this in state statute may not account for the unique nature of each county. Our farmers are struggling. With varying crop yields, threats from corporate farms, and general uncertainty in the commodities market and the future of ag programs, clean energy investment offers a crucial opportunity to livelihoods. Lease payments provide reliable income, allowing farmers and landowners to secure their financial future while contributing to U.S. energy independence and diversifying our electric grid. While this directly benefits local farmers and landowners, Minnesota's energy production tax keeps 100% of over $18 million annually in tax revenue in the counties where these projects are operating, offering financial security to county and municipal governments, in addition, easing the tax burden on hardworking residents. Thank you for hearing our comments and concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier will be Carol Oberland. If you could identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and other co-chairs and all members of the committee. My name is Carol Overland. I am an attorney from Red Wing. I've represented many citizens groups, individuals in wind projects, but I've been working in energy field for 30 years now, ranging from nuclear to coal gasification to incineration, on and on and on. But wind is this bill particularly is really needed. Minnesota does have rules about noise. This bill is about noise, primarily. It's probably also about shadow flicker. But we do have rules about noise. Minnesota Rule 7030-0040 is an MPCA rule that you can have no more than 50 decibels at night, essentially. That's a short version. I represented two clients in the Bent Tree Project, the Hagen family and the Langrud family. And we got settlements. This is the only settlements that have happened in the state of Minnesota to buy them out of their property. The reason why? Because they were too noisy. It was demonstrated by the Department of Commerce studies, and then it was replicated by those studies, and then Alliant did buy them out of their properties. And that happened about a little over 10 years ago. Since then, there have been no other settlements, and there's a reason why. In the Bentry settlements, after years and years of complaining, they finally, well, they got me on it, and we got the studies done, we got the studies replicated, and Alliant did settle instantly. Well, not instantly, but very, very quickly. And they wouldn't have settled if this noise issue was not real. You'll hear a lot of comments, claims from environmental organizations, other organizations, that say that they're just whining. But this has demonstrated that it was above the level allowed by Minnesota rule. The Hagans, they used to have to drive to a truck stop near Albert Lea to be able to sleep. The Langroods would drive over to Lake City from the Albert Lea area to sleep in their boat. This should not be happening to people. This is very real. And this is where House File 1859 comes in. After these settlements in the Bentry project, there were other applications, logically, and I was working with people on the Freeborn Wind project, and in that hearing, ultimately, the administrative law judge recommended that the application be denied because they had not demonstrated that they could comply with the noise standard. That's a first. That's never happened before. And application disappeared. Then a little while later, XL reapplied, and they were after moving some turbines to Iowa. And in that application, though, the noise study that they used a different ground factor. Now, normally, you know, in modeling studies, you have inputs. And the inputs have a lot to do with the output. And if you have garbage inputs, you're going to have garbage outputs. Well, the noise, the Minnesota rule, it was developed for industrial noise. And industrial noise is a source and then what they call receptors. Residents are called receptors. They're not very thrilled with that definition, but anyway. The noise standard is designed for a factor of 0.5, which means that it's about halfway blocked between the source and the receptor because of all the stuff on the ground, you know, buildings, trees, hills, whatever. And that's the norm for industrial noise from a ground to a receptor on the ground. Now, the problem is with wind, wind is figured up until just recently on a zero ground factor, because when you're looking at a wind turbine and you're trying to determine the noise impact on people, you've got a wind turbine way up in the air, and then you've got the receptor on the ground, and there is nothing in between. So it goes directly to them. And this is why this ground factor is important. And what happened is in the Freeborn project, in the beginning, the administrative law just said that they could not, they had not demonstrated that they could comply. So what happened then was, after Xcel applied, Xcel and the Commerce Department got together behind closed doors and changed guidance and allowed different ground factor. And they allowed Xcel to apply with a 0.5 ground factor for project that looked like this. That's wrong. We were interveners in that. We got no notice about it. We weren't invited to be part of the discussion, and they changed that. And since that time, every application for a wind project that has come in has been at 0.5, and now some are even coming in at 0.7. There is no excuse for this. And again, that's where HF 1859 comes in, because a one-mile setback would help alleviate this problem. People are suffering under those wind projects. They're living very close to them. You will hear, like, for example, in some of the letters that were provided, that Minnesota has a rigorous regulatory framework. No, Minnesota does not. Minnesota is subjecting landowners to impacts that are not workable. They can't live that way. And that's why this bill is particularly important, that one-mile setback, because there is no workable regulation of wind noise. Thank you. Any questions?
We'll finish with the last testifier first, and then we'll move to questions. The next testifier will be Jacob Bakke on Zoom. If you could identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee, especially for this opportunity to testify before you over a Zoom meeting, which I know is not ideal. My name is Jacob Bakke. I am a resident of Kennedy, Minnesota. Our town is located within the footprint of the proposed Enbridge Wind Farm project in northern Minnesota. So I'm here today to speak in support of the bill that Representative Burkle has put forward regarding the residential setbacks. You know, giving you some history, me and my wife, we bought our home here in 2015. And just one of the reasons that we purchased the place where we did was because of the natural beauty that we're surrounded by. And we have this large, expansive, wide open skies that we enjoy quite a bit. You know, one of the things that we do after dinner, once it gets warm, right? It's kind of cold right now, but one of the things that we do when it warms up is we like to go on a walk after dinner, go down our country road. And what I find myself doing on these walks is I'll sometimes pull up my camera and take pictures of the beautiful sunsets. And sometimes when there's big billowing clouds of storms rolling in, I'll take pictures of those because we get the really pretty skies. Now, I don't know how many of you have had the opportunity to go to New York City and see the Statue of Liberty. But I got to see it one time, and it was pretty impressive. It was so big. Now, one of the things that Enbridge supplied to us when they came and met with our community was a brochure. And in that brochure was a little infographic kind of explaining benefits of wind farms and, you know, some of the engineering marvels that they are able to accomplish. And one of the things that they had on there was a picture of the Statue of Liberty next to one of these modern wind turbines. And it's quite impressive. You know, the Statue of Liberty is 300 feet high. It's massive. And yet, one of these modern wind turbines standing next to it dwarfs it in size. It's almost double the size of the Statue of Liberty. It's incredible. Now, Enbridge isn't suggesting just putting in one of these wind turbines. Last I heard, it could be as many as 60 to 70 of these modern wind turbines put in and around my home. Now, I got to give credit where credit's due. Enbridge did a wonderful job when they came and met with our community. They graciously fed us dinner. They responded to our comments and concerns, and they answered a lot of questions, all but one question, and it spoke to me very profoundly. So during the town meeting that I attended, someone asked the Enbridge representatives, if they were in our position, would they want to have windmills built around their houses, like they're proposing to build around our homes? And not a single person from the Enbridge team raised their hand or admitted that they wouldn't have a problem with one of these large windmills being built next to their house. Now, to me, their silence spoke volumes. So I'm going to leave you guys with a similar question. You know, if you guys were going to have a wind farm built around your house, what would you want the setback to be? How far away would you want that thing built from your house? Now, thinking about those pictures I like to take of natural beauty around, you know, in and around my property, kind of makes me sad that within a few years, I might not be able to take such nice pictures anymore. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bakke. That concludes our testifiers. Is there anybody from the public that would like to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Burkle, for bringing this bill forward. I do appreciate the DE, which is significantly different from the original bill. I've got a couple of questions. My first one is, I understand the residents, right? We've had some passionate testimony about people's houses. What I'm trying to understand is why the 500-foot setback from the edge of a roadway, a county highway or county state-assisted highway?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins. There's instances where we've had ice spin off a blade, hit vehicles, situations like that. It's really a public safety issue.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Burkle. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting all of my niceties. I feel like maybe we should just like sit down and have a conversation at some point. But also, if this is a public safety issue, is there a reason it wasn't flagged previous by the Department of Public Safety or by local law enforcement or something?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hollins. No, I would say this is just circumstantial, and situations like this have occurred. Just put this in the bill in the hopes that it would outline the fact that this is something that can occur.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, that makes sense. And then my other question is, I guess, you know, I think when we first started, I remember we got paired together like back in 2000 over Zoom, and I told you that I grew up in a rural area, not here, but in Hawaii. And I guess when I'm thinking about this, I know that in a lot of rural areas, it's not like my house in St. Paul, right, where I'm like on like less than an eighth of an acre, tiny little space, houses 10 feet, 15 feet from me. There's usually a large amount of space. And I know when I grew up on acreage, right? It wasn't a small amount. So I'm wondering, do you know what the average size of parcel is in like your area or in general in greater Minnesota? Is it like that?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. I can't answer that in particular for Kitson County. I can say that Kitson County has 4,900 residents countywide. I couldn't give you the exact number. I have to do some math, but maybe, I don't know, do you have a rough idea of the average size farm? Maybe my testifier would have a guess.
Mr. DeZingle?
I can't attest to the average size of a farm or the average size of parcel, but as a farmer, one of my most common breakups of a field is called a quarter, which is a half mile by a half mile. And in Kitson County specifically, it's very broad, flat, and everything is almost perfectly gridded except for the occasional river. If I could broaden on that about the distance between houses and stuff, in my township, we have 14 households. I think there's 36 square miles. Kitson County has less than 5 people per square mile, including any what we would call a town. But my neighbor to the north is a mile away. My neighbor to the south is 1,700 feet away. My neighbor east of me is 5 miles, and my neighbor west is 5.5.
Ms. Overland, did you have something to contribute to the question at hand?
Yes, please. Thank you. One of the issues with this distance and siting is that many of the turbines are sited on land owned by absentee landowners. And then what they've tended to do, what I've found in my experience in working on 7 or 8 wind projects, challenging them in the siting of them, is that when they're sited on absentee landowners' land, they're often sited right next to homes on the neighboring land. And that is a problem. And so the people end up having to live right next to those turbines, and there's no one there. Or also, if someone gets a wind contract, then they avoid that person's home and they site it away from their home. And in each wind project contract, there is a section that says you can't sue. So the people that are hosting these wind turbines, they can't sue about any of the projects, but the neighbors, they have no recourse because they're living right next to it and they're having to live with it.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. I guess I'm a little perplexed because, so when we say residence, do we literally mean the house?
Yes.
Okay, and not the land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, that is very helpful for me because I know, right, like on my parents, the farm that they had, they specifically put their house in a place that was not near the edge of their land to make sure that whatever the neighbors ended up doing was not going to bug them. But I will say they also have neighbors that have, we don't have any wind turbines, but we do have some solar that has been put in nearby and, you know, have experienced, you know, I'm only speaking from my personal experience, but have experienced no negative consequences of that. And in fact, you know, they like it because it means that there's not other people there. They'd rather have a solar field next door to them than have people build their house right next door to them. So, but I understand what you're saying now. So residents, not necessarily the land. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Representative Swazinski. I should say Chair Sulinski.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Macklund. Are you a chair too, Burkle?
I'm a vice chair.
Vice Chair Burkle. It's usually a pretty good guess this session just to say that. But I appreciate the bill. You know, I think it's, I think siting in general is a conversation that we should be having, no matter what that is, whether that's whatever. You know, that's a conversation we have in rural Minnesota about barn siting. You know, where is a legitimate place to build a barn? So, you know, oftentimes, you know, if you're looking at a high head, those things are always considered on where it is, the proximity to other people's yard sites, and the rest. And so, you know, the letters are interesting, talking about, landowner rights and the rest. And it'd be interesting if those same groups would carry that conversation into other aspects and other places as well. And so, this is a solid bill. I think it's got some legs potentially. But just in general, I appreciate the willingness to conversation. I'm guessing some of the testifiers here had quite the drive, so we appreciate your willingness to come down. As a rural member, where a lot of these projects are sited, oftentimes it's a pretty big lift for folks to come down to the Capitol and make the drive and speak their minds. And it is a concern. It is a concern because oftentimes, you know, these are projects that are maybe XL or XL power purchase agreements that are not even on XL territory. Mm-hmm. These are XL projects that are being built or power purchase agreements or whatever on rural co-ops. And so, you know, how that process happens and that resource and the rest, and then who actually gets to decide. You know, is it folks here in St. Paul? Is it folks back home? You know, if there's a robust system, county by county, where county boards can make some of these decisions, I'm not sure. Maybe that would be a question to Ms. Carol Overland.
Thank you.
Yes, that would be my question. So how much influence does a local county board have on the siting of a solar farm, regardless of size, or a wind turbine, regardless of size, from rural residents? Could they just make a policy and stick to it, or how would that process work?
Full disclosure, I am on the thank you for your question, and thank you. I'm on the Planning Commission for Goodhue County, just full disclosure. The energy system for, like, wind projects, they have to be above, I think, a 50-megawatt level for the state to take it on, and then the counties only and townships only have the opportunity to participate as far as intervening or making comments in that process. Although townships do have an option because they control roads, you can have a township road ordinance that could prohibit use of those roads for putting wind projects in. So that has happened. I know of four townships that have done it. Two of them, I have worked on them with that. But essentially counties, the biggest problem is that counties don't have the expertise to deal with a wind project. Do they have any idea of noise modeling? You know, what do they know about that? What do they know about? And they know a lot about siting something and where the drain tile is, which is always an issue. But that's something that, you know, comes up in comments. But as far as the meat of the issue, you know, whether it's needed, would the county know anything about that? I doubt it. And so there are problems there. The counties don't have a robust system. Even, you know, the state doesn't even have a robust system. There are things that they should consider that they don't. So it is an issue, and it needs more conversation, absolutely, because this is getting to be a problem in, like, southwestern Minnesota. If you drive through there, drive down 90 at night and look at the lights flashing, and you'll see the impacts. They're everywhere.
Chair Sulinski? No. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vice Chair Burkle, for coming and speaking with us today. So I am just looking at the original bill and the DE and also the title of the purpose for the bill, and there was a big change I wanted to note, and I had some questions around that. So there were two big changes: one, that the DE includes solar, not just wind, but solar too, and then secondly, the change in the setbacks. Can you explain, please, those two changes?
I'll just go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the reason really for the big change, keep in mind, as my testifier explained, Kitson County is expansive. There's lots of area. When we think about space up there, a mile isn't very far, right? I drive 6 hours to get home. So, I mean, the concept was just really a placeholder of the bill to start the conversation based on my folks back home and the constituents who live in this area. But knowing that in my conversations with Great River Energy and others down here in the last couple of weeks, that was really a mile is a long way, right? And for companies to work with that, I realize that's an issue. At the same time, the noise pollution situation is real. And the more I've read about it, the more I understand about it, that's a conversation that just doesn't seem to be had. There's also an environmental impact on wildlife that's not really understood. Reproductive activity, mating habits. We talk about birds being hit by blades, but there's other things happening there. Predation issues and whether or not animals can evade predators the way they normally would. So there's a lot of things we don't really know about what's happening in the wildlife world too. But the mile setback initially was really just the start of the conversation with my folks back home, and the 500 feet is the evolution of that.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Burkle. So I appreciate the explanation as placeholder, and now you're kind of like narrowing it down. Having it be less extreme, that is a good thing. Can you also explain the other part of my question, why add solar to this?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. It's really just roping in all the renewable, really, and having the conversation around whether or not anybody wants a field of solar panels next to them. That's really the only reason it's in there.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Burkle. I kind of understand the rationale, but basically, based on what we've heard from testifiers, I mean, we've only been hearing about wind, and so that makes me really concerned that we're lumping in two technologies together that are very, very different in how they operate, the space that they take up, they're, you know, vertical versus horizontal. Just the impacts in general are very different, and so I have particular concerns about that, and it just doesn't seem to be the impetus of your bill.
Right.
Representative Burkle.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you want to comment too, but I understand what you're saying, and I agree. And when we're talking about noise, that's one thing. But I think what we're getting at and understanding, and I'll go back to Representative Holland's comment earlier about when we first came in. If you remember, we had this conversation about the cultures of where we live, right? And understanding that where we live in northwestern Minnesota is entirely different than just the space that we have, right? And having a huge solar field next to us. It's just not something we're used to. So it's really about what visually we're seeing. My testifier, Jacob Bakke, just talked about that at home, right? Going for that walk, being able to take that picture and not have lights shining and flashing everywhere is really what he's talking about. So it's a culture thing as much as anything.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment about setbacks?
Ms. Overland.
Thank you. Typically for a wind project, it was 1,000 foot setback was standard, and now it's risen to 1,500. That's the typical setback from a residence for a wind project.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifier, and Vice Chair Burkle. I guess I'm a little confused because it seems to be a little all over the place. We've heard about culture, we've heard about noise, we've heard about environmental impact. And that just the differences in the technologies, it just feels a little just not focused. And so, I just want to make that comment that I don't know that we're fully, I think to your point, you know, you went from your initial bill to the DE and like we're kind of narrowing, but I don't feel like we're really there. So thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Representative Burkle. So mine's a question is an extension of Representative Jones' question. On solar, why have the setback that you're proposing on roads?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the reason would be snow removal in our area is a big deal, right? But what have we got here?
Glare.
Oh, glare, yes, glare too. But I think the issue is, once again, public safety would be part of it, and some removal, and as my testifier just wrote down, glare from solar panels along roads.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, so if you want snow removal, I could see maybe, I don't know, 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, but 500 feet? What kind of snow removal are you doing up there?
You haven't seen the snow we have up there. You need to come and see the snow. You're forgetting, right?
Representative Kraft, are
you? Okay, I think I'm good. I really appreciate the discussion on the wind. I think there's some valid points. I think you're stretching it on the solar comments. Thanks.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question or comment doesn't deal directly with placement, but it would have to do with having these wind towers around a farm. And Mr. DeZingle, I don't know exactly what crops you raise. I would guess probably soybeans and wheat, probably corn, canola maybe. Anyway, you know, and all those crops need to be sprayed during the growing season. And could you talk about if you had a really wet period and you couldn't get your ground rig out in your field and you may have to have an airplane come in there to spray your crops? Would that be possible if you had wind turbines kind of surrounding your farmland?
Representative Burkle?
I think my testifier is going to take that. Thank you.
Yes, to Mr. DeZingle.
Thank you. We actually do rely on aerial spraying, specifically for fungicide, just because once the crop reaches a certain height, you do damage, undue damage, with the wheels that you have on your equipment. And yes, when it does rain, with the lack of elevation change where we are, I mean, it is very flat. We're talking a 2-foot difference on a mile west of my yard. And my local ag sprayer was not too excited to know that there would be wind turbines going in. And it is a huge risk. We had asked Enbridge about that safety on spraying around them. And yes, a stationary object is easy to avoid. The issue is that if they're operating them, that's not a stationary object. So we asked, what happens if I need it turned off? And they said, absolutely. We can absolutely shut that off. And we said, well, when you're spraying, you generally need the correct wind because your neighbor might not have the right crop for any kind of overspray. And they said, well, we would need a couple weeks to turn one off. And we said, well, most of the time we get 30 minutes. I don't know if anybody's seen Midwest weather, but it's very quick to change.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. That's a great answer, but it's difficult. Wind turbines create a real turbulence behind their blades. And the testifier that was online talked about the towers being about 600 feet high. And I was at a meeting back home this past summer where this same topic was discussed. And when you add the rotor to the top of that turbine up there, you're talking 650 pushing 700 feet high, these really big new turbines can be. So really big structures, they're very efficient, but it does make farming around them a real challenge. So thank you, Mr. DeZingle.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Burkle, for bringing this bill. I just have a couple comments about the inclusion of solar. So I was fortunate enough, just in the later part of March, we had the University of Minnesota people come and talk to us about solar fences. And my suggestion is we have all these fences along I-90, and we could put these solar panels right on where those fences are, and that'd be a great idea. And I learned quickly that won't work. And the reason it won't work, if you look at where the snow fences are, they're not in the right of way. They're back a long ways. You know what they told us at the University of Minnesota? What's the reason they need to be all the way back in the field? Is it's the top height, not the bottom height. I suggested, why don't we just open up the bottom a lot? And they said, it won't work. He said, you'll create so much turbulence from having that height high. Mm-hmm. If you park those solar panels right next to the road, we're going to agitate the snow going across the road. And so that's the reason why there should be a setback for solar. But it has everything to do with how tall those solar fences are, and that's handy from the University of Minnesota. So thank you for the bill.
And the last one is a very, very brief statement or question from Representative Weiner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but actually Representative Murphy kind of stole my thunder, because when the wind blows out in greater Minnesota, there is generally what happens, especially in the open countries, they'll leave rows of corn to collect that snow. And it has to be far enough away, if it's too close to the roads, MnDOT, counties, and so forth have a real tough time because the snow will build up on the roads. So it is a safety issue, and if you're not there, if you don't experience it, I understand the questioning. 500 feet does sound like a lot. At the same time, when that wind is blowing, I can think of Starbucks, some of those areas at the top of the hills, those snow fences are a long ways back. Mm-hmm. When it comes over the hills and starts piling up, and I think that's kind of the intent of this, is to make sure that we don't cause another problem by putting these solar panels, farms, too close to the roads. So it's a valid reason. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no more questions. Oh, Sexton. Representative Sexton.
Well, thanks, everyone. I've been reaching out to a friend. I happen to be good friends with a gentleman who manages all of the wind farms down in the I-90 area. And one of the questions I had, being familiar with rotary wing aircraft and the rotors on those wind turbines, is slinging ice. And I'm not so sure 500-foot setback from roadway is far enough, because they accumulate ice faster as they're spinning, much like I did when I flew helicopters. And then once they start melting off, it starts slinging it, and they actually, according to him, have to shut down in that instance about 5 or 6, maybe more, times per year. And that's that company's policy, but that's not a policy overall. And a chunk of ice coming off a rotor blade that large would be the size of a car coming your way that you wouldn't see coming. Just give you a little perspective. So I'm not so sure 500 feet back from a roadway is far enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Burkle, any closing statements?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all share an understanding that various forms of energy each have their own importance, but I think this bill is a reasonable approach to starting the conversation, and I want to really thank my testifiers, Paul Inter, for making the long 6-hour-plus trip down from Kitson County to share his situation, and really look forward to the continued conversation. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. With that, House File 1859, as amended, will be laid over for further consideration. And Chair Akam, would you like to opine?
I'm not opining. I just want to thank you for the bill presentation today. Wanted to maybe talk about next week. We are scheduled to meet again on Tuesday to hopefully go through a negotiated budget bill for our committee. We're in the process of negotiating, waiting for some feedback from the GOP on offers that have been made. So certainly hope that we can gather on Tuesday to walk through that bill, and thank you all for your involvement in that.
With that, that concludes our business for today, and we are adjourned.